This order isn't worth the paper it's printed on and will be struck down by the courts. Attempting to weaponize the census for political gain is yet another racially driven attack by a president and an administration that wrongly views immigrants as the enemy. It's mean, it's vicious, it's typical of Donald Trump.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer blasting President Trump's latest effort to exclude undocumented immigrants from the 2020 census. He signed a memorandum yesterday to cut undocumented immigrants out of the population counts. These counts are used to draw congressional districts, and California is already on track to lose one congressional seat. It's not clear if this is even doable or legal, and immigrant rights groups have promised to sue. It is another layer of chaos in an already chaotic census effort because of the pandemic. The Census Bureau will soon launch a big push to count people who didn't respond to the first round of questions by mail or online. And this means workers will go door to door and into hard to count communities like RV parks and homeless shelters. They wear masks, but still, there is a risk, especially here in California, home to the nation's largest number of COVID cases. Earlier today, I spoke with a census worker we're calling Jay. It's his first initial. And he asked us not to use his full name because he's afraid he could lose his job. So tell me what you do. What do you do at the census?
So I am a clerk. You know, I'm making phone calls to different sites that, you know, our enumerators and field supervisors go out to. You know, I'm organizing paperwork. I'm putting together kits for the enumerators to go out to facilities, that kind of stuff. It's a support role for the census at large.
So you're not out there knocking on doors and talking to people?
That's correct. Yeah, I'm in the office supporting the folks who are getting ready to do that.
Right. And still, though, you think your work environment is unsafe?
Well, yeah, because it's a closed office environment, because it's indoors, and because of the sheer number of people that we have in the office. I mean, just last week or so, I was in there, and, you know, we had 30 people in one office, in an office space. And that, you know, that's three times the recommended 10-person amount. I mean, even posted in the building, the building's COVID restrictions are saying don't have a gathering of more than 10 people. And we easily have that on a daily basis.
And are they staying apart or trying to? Are they wearing masks?
I mean, there's a mask mandate. You definitely still see the same sort of mask faux pas that you see out in the world, you know, they're on their nose or they're, you know, kind of falling off or, you know, people, you know, and obviously people can't wear them all day. People still, you know, they're in the break room. They have to eat their lunch and stuff like that. And yeah, there is an attempt at social distancing. The desks have been placed, what they say is 6 feet apart. So I imagine it's the chair is 6 feet apart, but they're also still facing each other. Those desks, They're set in kind of like little quads, you know, little four-person cubes or whatever, and all of those people are sitting there facing each other.
Yeah. Well, why can't you and the other workers do your work from home?
The main thing has got to be a security issue. We're dealing with, you know, sensitive data, people's personal information, that kind of thing. I imagine part of it is the access to the programs that we're using. I mean, they're web-based programs, but I imagine that we're on a secure server. You know, right now we are in the office physically putting together things to distribute to the people who are going out and knocking on doors, the enumerators and stuff like that. So that sort of requires us to be in the office.
So do those people, after they've been out and about knocking on doors and talking to people, do they come back to the office?
Yes. So the only people we've sent out so far are what they call field supervisors, census field supervisors. And those folks have been out in the field, in a couple of cases, actually gone to certain facilities, like skilled nursing facilities, things like that, where people are grouped together and have patients and people there who have tested positive for COVID. So we've definitely had people go out there, pick up materials from a site that had people tested positive for COVID and then bring that back in a trash bag.
And is it wiped down, sanitized?
I mean, once we get it, yeah. I mean, I when I received it, I wiped it down. I double bagged it. I sanitized it, brought it up, and we have a UV light up there. So, I mean, we're definitely taking precautions. I think that, at least as far as my office goes, they are doing the best that they can, but it largely falls on the office people themselves to take care of this kind of stuff, to provide, like our office manager has provided most of the sanitary equipment there, the wipes, the hand sanitizer, the alcohol spray bottles, or other staff is kind of responsible for bringing that sort of stuff in. So we haven't necessarily been supported by the census at large.
Hmm. So in the meantime, I guess you'll just keep showing up to work and hope that you don't get COVID.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm going to have to do. Right now, when everybody else in the country is unemployed, not everybody else, but like there's, you know, record unemployment right now, it's actually a pretty good paying job. You know, it's a good gig, and to try to leave it to go into employment limbo, you know, it's not a great idea. It's a tough choice.
Yeah. So let me just ask you this. When you think of like the difficulties and the fact that your local supervisor has to supply the protective stuff like sanitizer and spray bottles, and you have all these people coming into the office, who do you blame for that? Like, who are you angry with, and who do you think should amend the practices?
It's got to come from the top down. I mean, ultimately, this administration is clearly showed a failure in leadership when it comes to all things COVID. I think part of my anger or part of my anxiety comes from just not really knowing what to trust and what is safe, and not like how much actual danger am I in. Like sometimes I feel like, am I just being alarmist? Am I just freaking out for no reason? Should I just take it easy and do my work and it's no big deal? But at the same time, cases are spiking here in California. It just feels like we're playing a sort of Russian roulette here. One of my coworkers actually is out sick right now, and they got a test, but they haven't gotten their test results back because testing is now backed up. And you know, this is a person I worked very closely with, and now they're out sick, and we don't know whether they're COVID positive or not.
So you might be COVID positive.
I mean, I'm at this moment, like I'm asymptomatic. Like I don't feel sick. I don't have a fever or cough or anything like that. I feel totally fine. So yeah, maybe again, like maybe my chances of actually getting sick from this person or being sick right now, it's pretty slim. But yeah, that it's possible that they might be.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I hope you're okay. Let me know.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with us today, and good luck.
No, thank you, Madeline. I appreciate it.
That's Jay. Wanted to go by his first initial. He's a current U.S. Census worker here in Southern California. Let's talk more about why getting an accurate census count is especially important for a place like Los Angeles. With me now to explain what's at stake this year is Arturo Vargas. He is CEO of the National Association of Latino Elected Officials. Hello.
Hello.
Well, first of all, let me just get your reaction to what President Trump has said, and he wants the Census Bureau to not count undocumented immigrants. That will certainly be litigated, but for now, what do you think the effect will be? Will it be even harder to count people?
Well, two things. First, the president did not say don't count undocumented immigrants in the census. What the president is proposing to do is to have the Census Bureau, after it completes the census, to remove a certain number of people from each state that it believes are undocumented immigrants, so that there is a new number to be used to reapportion the House of Representatives. The president wants to amend the Constitution through a memo, which is really an assault on American sensibility and utterly ridiculous.
Right. And he's arguing, well, we don't count foreign diplomats when they're here or foreign students when they're here studying. So,
well, actually, he's incorrect. We do count foreign diplomats if they are residing in the United States. We do not count foreign students, and we do not count people who are here on vacation, you know, just visiting the United States. We count everybody else who is living in the United States as of April 1 of the census year. And this goes to the wording of the Constitution. And it says that there shall be an enumeration of the whole number of persons. Now, it doesn't say the whole number of citizens or men or white people. It says the whole number of persons.
So that will be litigated. What do you think the immediate effect, though, will have on the ongoing effort to count people here?
Well, in fact, it's been litigated before, and there is precedent already at the Supreme Court level with regard to trying to use estimates and sampling for purposes of apportionment. But that aside, we have always been very concerned about this administration using its rhetoric and ways to intimidate the immigrant population through a whole wide range of policy initiatives that has been a campaign by this administration, including trying to scare people away from participating in the census. Now, an inaccurate census only harms everybody, because any state that does not have an accurate count of its population for the next 10 years will not be receiving its fair share of political representation, of resources that are distributed by the federal government every year. We're talking about $1.5 trillion. And the population data will be inaccurate when it comes to making key policy decisions. You know, we're dealing with this COVID pandemic right now. And the fact is that not everybody was counted in the 2010 census. So even the numbers that are being used by the County of Los Angeles to try to respond to the pandemic, they're off already because the 2010 census was inaccurate to begin with.
Yeah. Well, do you think that this will scare off people from answering the census questions or from speaking to a census worker?
Well, we know people are afraid to speak to census workers, regardless of this latest development. People believe that the information they provide to the Census Bureau may be shared not just with immigration authorities, but perhaps with the landlord or with some other authority. And people are afraid that harm may come to them if they fully divulge how many people are living in their households. But we have to remind everybody that the census is, in fact, completely confidential and safe.
Well, how do you do that? How do you convince a farm worker who might be here without documents that it's in his best interest?
It's a heavy lift, because we have to convince people to trust us as advocates and to trust this administration that it's going to comply with the law. One of the things that we have done as well is some messaging research. How do you speak to people about the census and the importance of the census? And we have learned that if you explain that the census is used in order to ensure full funding for schools, for clinics, for highway repair, that they understand the connection between census participation and the future well-being of their families.
Well, has it worked?
Well, not completely, because if you look at self-response rates so far, only about 62% of households nationwide had self-responded to the census. Now, California is doing a little bit better than the rest of the country, I believe a reflection of the investment to do a state-based campaign to encourage all Californians to fill out their forms. But if we look at heavily Latino population areas, response rates are even below the California statewide response rate. So we have a big lift ahead of us in order to try to get this count right.
What's the deadline?
Well, the new deadline now is October 31st. The original deadline was July 31st, but because the entire census was disrupted by the COVID-19 pandemic, the Bureau had to suspend its field operations for 2 months and has now extended the enumeration period to the end of October. But the danger with having such a long enumeration period, although we may have more time to count people, the further you get from that census day, that reference date of April 1st, the less accurate the data become. People forget who was living with them on April 1, and people have moved since then, and especially now given the current circumstances. So there is a danger that even with this more time of October 31st, we may end up with a less accurate census, and that just harms everybody.
Well, President Trump, in this latest round of coronavirus relief package negotiations, wants $1 billion to conduct a speedy census. That's, I think, the terminology. What does that mean exactly? And would that mean that workers would have less time to count people?
Well, the Census Bureau already has asked for more time because they know they cannot complete the job under the current deadlines. There's just laws of physics here at play in terms of the Bureau simply not having the people power necessary to hire, train, and deploy more people in a shortened period of time under the current circumstances created by the pandemic. Just throwing another $1 billion at the Bureau is not going to solve the problem. And the professionals at the Census Bureau know that.
Well, given the fact that there are so many people out of work, is there now demand? Do people want to work for the census?
Actually, the Census Bureau will say that they're doing very well at recruiting, but we also know that many people are, in fact, having second thoughts about going door to door and knocking on people's doors under the current environment. It's going to be very difficult.
If you were running the Census Bureau and running the count, what would you do right now to get more people to comply?
Well, the first thing I would do if I were running the Census Bureau is completely redo its communications campaign and speak directly and frankly to the American people about how important it is to fill out your census form for the well-being of our communities. I mean, I look at these census ads that have been professionally developed, and the Census Bureau is paying millions of dollars for them to run on television, but they're just a little bit of a feel-good, civic duty type message. People are living in crisis today. People have lost their jobs. People are seeing family members die. We have to meet the American public where it is in terms of encouraging them to take a civic action that can contribute to improving our situation for the long term. And that's the message I would want to communicate.
Arturo Vargas, he is CEO of the National Association of Latino Elected Officials. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, how Orange County became one of California's coronavirus hotspots. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. California is now the epicenter of the nation's coronavirus outbreak, passing New York with the most COVID-19 infections, more than 400,000, according to Johns Hopkins. Southern California is the state's hotspot, and now Orange County has the second most cases in the state after Los Angeles. We're going to talk about the county's response with Orange County Supervisor Lisa Bartlett. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, your county now has more than 30,000 cases, more than 500 deaths. How did that happen?
Well, when you consider the state of California, we have 58 counties, and Orange County is the third most populous county in the state with more than 3.2 million people. So just by the sheer numbers of our population in our county, our COVID numbers are probably going to be higher than a county that's got 4,000 residents, for instance. So we have to keep those things in perspective when you look at the overall numbers and why our numbers are higher relative to other counties.
Right. And Los Angeles is high. Riverside is high. Still, you're higher than San Diego, which is also an urban center.
That is correct, yes. So we are watching things very closely. At the present time, even though our positivity rates are going up, we still have plenty of capacity in our hospital and ICU beds with over 40% capacity, and we have over 60% capacity with our ventilators.
So California allowed your county to open restaurants for indoor dining 2 days before Memorial Day. You're back on the state's monitoring list, which means a lot of things are closed down again, gyms, churches, et cetera. Did Orange County reopen too soon?
You know, it's hard to say whether our county opened too soon. We are looking at the numbers on a daily basis. We are tracking things from Memorial Day and with some of the peaceful protests that were going on in the county and looking at the spikes in some of our numbers. One thing that we are looking at right now is, so three things relative to the COVID numbers. Originally, we had a large outbreak in our skilled nursing facilities, but those numbers are now reduced and are under control. And our jail inmate population, COVID numbers are under control. And same thing with our homeless population. Those numbers are under control through Project Room Key. So now most of the COVID cases that are new are based on community transmission. And that's something that is of concern to all of us because we can't just wrap Orange County in a bubble and try to keep our numbers running steady. So it's a matter of people complying voluntarily with our face covering guidelines, washing hands frequently, using hand sanitizer, and social distancing. One thing that personally concerns me is over 50% of our new cases are within the age group of age 20 to age 45. And that's very concerning.
Yeah, I just want to play a clip of a viral video of two comedians who went to Huntington Beach to hand out masks.
Are you pro-mask, bro?
Do you want a mask? Thanks. It's all fake, dude. Come on.
Good, man.
Nah, man, that's a fraud.
I like freedom, dog.
I like fresh air. Just shut down the country? That's bullshit.
I'm good.
But does wearing a mask shut down the country?
When you close down half the economy,
yeah.
I think so.
But can't we open it up quicker if we all wear masks?
Nah, dude, that's a talking point on the TV, bro. He says it's not a mask, it's a muzzle.
What?
Okay, so yeah, this was a you know, a couple of comedians, but still they do capture a certain segment, and the resistance to mask wearing, does that concern you?
It does concern me because there is a certain percentage of the population that for whatever reason they are resistant to wearing a face covering or a face mask. And right now, individually, we need to be responsible and do everything in our power to slow the spread of COVID-19. And wearing a face covering or mask is part of that health and safety protocol. So, yes, it does concern me when individuals don't want to help us as a society and try to slow the spread of COVID-19.
Right. But, I mean, it's not just individuals. The Board of Ed recently said it was okay for schools to reopen without requiring masks.
Yes, that's what has come down the pipeline from the Board of Education. And I know that there are some concerns with a lot of parents relative to face masks and children in schools. And it really runs the gamut. You find parents that don't want to send their child to school if they have to wear a face mask, or they don't want to send their child to school if the children aren't going to wear a face mask. So it's a very energized topic of conversation right now. And relative to the schools, I don't know what will ultimately take place. But on a day-to-day basis with people out in public, with community transmission spreading, with people in public facing other people in public, and if you're not wearing a mask, then they're not able to really protect themselves and those around them. And we're never going to be able to get a handle and slow the spread of COVID-19 if we don't get compliance. And so voluntary compliance right now is really critical in us able to open up our economy again. We have businesses that are now able to get reopened, and we'd like to keep them open. But the only way we can do that is to keep people healthy in Orange County. And healthy people means that we're going to be able to reopen our county that much faster and stay open.
But aren't officials sending mixed messages? You have that vote I just mentioned. You also have the fact that your previous public health director, Nicole Quick, had to resign after she issued a mandatory countywide mask rule. And then her successor rescinded the order. So aren't you in high office giving conflicting messages?
I think the message that is consistent coming from the county is that we have a consistent message of whenever you cannot socially distance in public, please wear a face covering to protect yourself and to protect those around you.
Well, it's a state law, so how do you enforce that? It's not just voluntary, it's mandatory statewide.
Right. Enforcement is a challenge. I had an hour and a half conversation with Sheriff Barnes the other day, and every county's got limited resources on the things that they need to tackle on a day-to-day basis relative to public safety. So mask enforcement is something, you know, you'd have to talk to the sheriff about and get his response. But in my discussion with him yesterday, I know that he had sent a letter up to Governor Newsom, and we want to be very cooperative and work with the state relative to voluntary compliance with the mask order coming from the state, and also collaboration with the strike team that is prevalent now throughout the state. I believe there are 10 strike teams that can assist local jurisdictions like our counties to work on the enforcement of face coverings.
Well, Sheriff Barnes has said it's not law enforcement's job to enforce. He said he would only punish people for what he called egregious violations. Do you agree with that?
Well, in my conversation with him the other day, he understands the importance of everyone wearing a face covering right now. And I know that I asked him pointedly, would you cooperate with the state strike team and getting compliance in place for businesses that are currently not compliant or individuals that are not compliant? And he said yes. So I think the tide is changing a bit relative to moving more towards the enforcement type of action, because there are individuals out there and businesses out there that simply don't want to comply with the state's public health and safety guidelines. And we really need compliance at this point in order to slow the spread of COVID-19, because our numbers are going up in Orange County. We still have plenty of capacity within our healthcare system. But people need to understand that while we have capacity in Orange County, we are linked to three other counties within the Cal OES hospital system. So we are linked with L.A. County, Riverside County, and San Diego County. And currently, Riverside County has no additional capacity in their healthcare system. So at some point in time, we could be getting patients from Riverside County into Orange County, which further impacts our numbers relative to capacity within our healthcare system.
All right. You heard it here. Wear a mask. Lisa Bartlett, Orange County Supervisor. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much.
Coming up, the couple who redefined women's gymnastics, Bella and Marta Caroli, and how their strict training slid into abuse.
Many more athletes felt there was really no care for them as individuals. They were disposable. There was always someone else, if you got injured, to plug in.
How the Carolis built champions at a very steep price. Next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, if you are old enough to have watched the 1976 Olympics, you probably remember the moment when a tiny 14-year-old Romanian girl confidently leapt onto the uneven bars.
Nadia Comăneci. Now, what are the judges going to say about that? And 10 has gone on the board. That's perfection. And that is Olympic history for Nadia Comăneci.
That performance catapulted her to fame, along with her coaches, Bella and Marta Caroli. Based on their reputation as Nadia's coach, the Carolis built an empire, eventually taking American gymnastics to even greater heights than the homeland they left behind in the Iron Curtain, Romania. But it all came crashing down in the wake of the Larry Nassar sexual abuse scandal amid allegations the Carolis knew about his abuse and turned a blind eye to it. The Crowley story is told in a new ESPN podcast. It's called Heavy Metals. Alyssa Roenick and Bonnie Ford are the reporting team behind the project, and they join me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And just a warning to listeners, we are going to be talking about instances of sexual abuse, which may be disturbing to you. So a warning there. Let's go to the beginning, to Romania, and hear from a Romanian gymnast you spoke with about the Corallis and how they trained her back then before they came to the United States. Here is Gabi Jaiculescu.
Two little crackers in the morning. It was a little food, but it was not enough. I mean, I ate toothpaste because I was not able to sleep. I was so hungry. We were eating leftovers on the street. If you find a little apple that was like half eaten, and you would pick it up.
Now, it was pretty bad in Romania back then for everybody, but what was happening at this training camp that the Corallis are running?
Everything that we associate with that hardcore Eastern Bloc training style was in effect there, including deprivation of food, hiding of injuries, overtraining, very little, if any, contact with family or friends. And I was the one who did that particular interview. And I can tell you that Gabby's been in the United States a long time. She owns a gym in Nashville. She has a grown daughter. She's just a lovely woman. But when she talks about those times, you can see how deeply it still affects her.
Wow. And so that technique of starving the girls, that was done to keep them small so that they would, I guess, do better performing?
I think that was the belief, especially at the time. You know, before 1976, really before 1972, women's gymnastics was just that. You know, the women were over 20, they had women's bodies. And when he essentially proved in his mind that this was working and younger, smaller gymnasts could tumble higher and fly higher and spin faster, that became the norm in the sport.
So let's hear from two gymnasts from the later generation, Dominique Moceanu and Carrie Strug. Here's what they told you.
We had to live at the ranch. And the equipment was subpar. It wasn't really the best equipment. Our legs were dead. I think it's like legendary between all the Corallis gymnasts that that floor was so hard. And we're like, if we can do it here, we can do it anywhere.
The two of us were in this little cabin and there was three bunk beds, one bathroom, a kitchen, and a couch. There was a TV with like two channels and it was steps away from the gym. And you would hear Bella's four-wheeler and know that it was time to get out that door. Go to the gym.
So this is his gym in Southeast Texas, the ranch. And did he and his wife recreate what they had in Romania, in Texas?
Slowly but surely, yes. More than anything, what they recreated was the control and the oversight that they had in Deva. Parents were not allowed. Bonnie and I took a trip out to the ranch in March. And, you know, there's a sign hanging that's been hanging there since the early 80s on the side of the original gym. You know, no parents allowed on premises. They had complete control.
And nobody raised a red flag at the time. No one said, this is abuse. This is like a cult. You know, why aren't parents allowed to see their children?
That kind of control and rigid oversight just became normalized over the years. And there are two distinct phases of the Corallis' careers. One is from the time they started in Romania through the 96 Olympics when they were personal coaches. And then the other is from very late 1999/2000 when USA Gymnastics brought Bella and Marta, because they were always a package deal, but nominally brought Bella out of retirement to run the national team program. So at that point, he is not a hands-on coach. He's an administrator who's supposed to set standards for all of the other coaches and expectations for the whole program. And the key thing is that USA Gymnastics designated the ranch as the national team training center. So they had the venue, they had the administrative control, and they had a track record of creating medalists in USA Gymnastics' eyes that no one else was capable of.
In the second phase that you talk about, Marta Corallis takes over, right? She becomes the national team coordinator. And initially, the gymnasts think, okay, so that's going to be a relief. No more of this overbearing, big, huge personality of Bella controlling our lives. Marta is now going to be in control. But in many ways, she turned out to be worse than Bella, or more exacting, more fixated on power. Can you describe how she ran the team?
Well, I'm not sure I want to rank them because different gymnasts had different relationships with them or reacted differently to each of their styles, depending on how they were wired and where they were in the pecking order at the time. But certainly, as you say, there was a sort of relief of, okay, nothing could be as bad as Bella, not only because he was overbearing and had a very considerable ego and a tendency to take credit and shift blame, but he also was not a detail guy. He was not an organization guy. So Marta, at least, had a sort of an orderly process that the athletes knew what was expected of them. And in the first few years of her tenure, several gymnasts told us that they had pretty good relationships with her. But everything changes, it seems, starting in 2003, 2004, when the U.S. had success at the World Championships, won a team gold. Carly Patterson won an individual gold medal in Athens in 2004. That really, who knows what would have happened if they hadn't had that success, but it certainly solidified Marta's grip on the program and her job security. And from there, although the teams, of course, had an incredible run of success from 2008 through 2016, it seemed that many more athletes felt detached, felt that there was really no care for them as individuals, that they were disposable. It was a numbers game. There was always someone else, if you got injured, to plug in your place, so you weren't going to complain about injuries. And again, we're seeing the same silencing as we saw two or three decades before that.
So Larry Nassar came into the scene around 1996, is that right?
With the national team, yes.
Yeah, and he is accused of abusing hundreds of girls. How much did the Carollis know what was happening?
That is the million-dollar question. And to be honest with you, we don't have a full answer. We ask this question to every athlete we interview, to every person we interview. You know, how much do you think the Carollis knew? How much do you think Marta knew? For every gymnast who said to us, I don't know what she knew, I don't know if she knew, or I don't want to believe she knew, you know, we had someone who either said she absolutely had to have known, or at least said, you know, Marta had eyes on the back of her head, the back of her knees, on her elbows. She saw everything that went on in that gym. So how could she not have known? Now we do know, because of her deposition that she gave in 2017, we know that she knew at least in 2015. So a year before the Indianapolis Star story broke, she was aware that allegations had been made that he had sexually abused a gymnast, and she did not turn him over to law enforcement, and she did not inform any other coach or parent in her program.
We've gotten a lot of questions from listeners and readers about why the Carollis were not charged criminally. And there is no evidence per se from any athlete we've spoken to that either of them, and Marta, of course, who was running the program at the time, would have been the one, were in a room when an athlete was sexually abused. But we also know that Larry Nassar abused some gymnasts when their parents were in the room. And he was very good at concealing and deceiving and conning people. So the only way that the Carollis likely could have been held accountable criminally is if they had been charged with failure to report. And Texas authorities decided not to do that. So closure is delayed. We don't know if it'll ever come, but certainly there are many survivors who want to hear something from the Carollis, some kind of admission of responsibility or at least an apology for what happened on their property at the ranch.
Hmm. I want to ask you about Simone Biles. She was sexually abused by Larry Nassar. She is also the most decorated gymnast in American history. What does she and the other gymnasts you interviewed, what do they say about the price that they've had to pay for this success?
Simone does not go to the topic easily of talking about Larry Nassar. You know, she's made it clear over and again that she won't be defined by his abuse. You know, one of the things that's incredibly remarkable about her specifically is, you know, the question looming. And, you know, one of the questions, you know, we posed at the beginning of this project is, was there another way to win? And Simone Biles is this incredible example of the fact that that's just not true. Her first coach, her longtime coach, came from outside of the elite world. She was not at all enamored by, you know, elite gymnastics and the Olympics and Marta Karoly. And so she bucked the system all along the way. Her mother said the same thing. I'm going to be in your face. I'm going to be asking questions. And unfortunately, all of that couldn't protect her from Larry Nassar. But she is someone who came up being loved and supported and, you know, allowed to eat what she wanted and sleep when she wanted and have a voice on social media and have fun and giggle and talk at practice and just do things differently. And she's the greatest gymnast maybe the world's ever seen, right? So she is this physical embodiment who is still competing, who is not only using her voice to change the sport and the culture, but it was also proof that there is and was another way to win.
So that is a hopeful note to end on, that it doesn't have to end in this dark place. Is there now a different attitude to training and to what they should and should not endure?
I don't think we have a full answer yet, but what I will say is that for a couple of reasons, the dysfunction of the national governing body, USA Gymnastics, over the last 3 to 4 years has prevented meaningful reform from happening. So that's number one. Number two, we have a pandemic where, you know, all of international sport is on pause. And so we may not have a chance to see what this elevated consciousness, what that becomes. I mean, certainly one of the reasons that Alyssa and I wanted to do this project in the first place is that at the time when we started, Tokyo was going to be the first Summer Olympic Games without the Karolys since the 70s. But the culture of abusive coaching that took years to develop and perfect itself is also going to take years to eradicate.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having us and helping tell this story.
Thank you so much.
Alyssa Runick and Bonnie Ford, their new podcast is called Heavy Metals Inside the Karoly Gymnastics Empire, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up, is it safe to get on a plane right now? An expert is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Airplanes have long had a terrible reputation for squeezing in passengers like sardines, cutting legroom and seat space to pack bodies into every possible space just for a few extra bucks or a lot of extra bucks. It was a nightmare even before COVID times, meaning now it's something beyond a nightmare. Many airlines are still filling airplanes with mask-clad passengers. Others, though, are selling limited tickets. They're keeping the middle seats empty, even building little pods for passengers. We're going to talk about all that now with Brian Summers. He covers airlines for Skift. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Madeline.
Well, no one's having a good time on airplanes these days. Where is the worst place to be right now when it comes to being on an airplane?
Well, arguably, it's a better time to fly now than it was a year ago, because on a lot of airlines, you are no longer hemmed in like sardines. As you mentioned, there are at least three airlines, JetBlue, Delta, and Southwest, that essentially aren't selling middle seats, so you have more room to spread out. If these were normal times, people would be very excited about that. The problem is, of course, we have COVID-19, and so the travel experience that people remember is not coming back. It isn't here, and for that reason, it is not a good time to fly. For example, mm-hmm. if you're flying now, you must wear a mask.
And if you're on American or United, you might be crammed next to someone. They are selling the middle seats, right?
That's right. American and United are selling the middle seats. They are giving customers an option, though. Both of the airlines say that they will contact passengers if their flights are booked at more than 70% and say, look, your flight looks like it's going to be full. do you want to switch to another one for no charge? Both of those airlines say almost nobody is taking them up on their offer. Turns out if you really want to go to San Francisco or Vegas or wherever you're going, you want to go on the flight you are planning to go on and not one 4 hours later or the next day.
Should you pay more money to upgrade to business or first class? Is it safer up there?
Arguably, no. You know, we all follow the rules, or we're supposed to follow the rules. Generally, when you're not in the air, you're supposed to be 6 feet away from other people. The reason that American and United don't block middle seats, they say, is because there's no such thing as social distancing on an airplane. Even if you block the middle seat, you are much closer than 6 feet away from the person next to you. So in business class, you would have more room, but you're still not social distancing according to the real rules of the game. So in this case, if the virus is your worry, coach is probably as good as the front of the plane.
And what about the air? The air that is circulated throughout the airplane.
This is a big deal for airlines. Airlines say this idea that you get sick more often on the airplane is false. They never really pushed back on it before, but they say they pretty much use the same filters as hospitals, HEPA grade filters to filter the air. You're basically not breathing the same air as other people, they say, and they say it's perfectly safe to be in the air. So that's the good news. Of course, the problem is if you go to LAX or any other airport, it's not about just being on the airplane. The airports don't have these filters. Certainly the car that you ride on to get to the airport doesn't have these filters. The jet bridge doesn't have these filters. So if you're waiting to get on the airplane and you're a foot away from somebody else, you would get sick that way. Airlines do a pretty good job of controlling the air quality on the airplane itself, but the rest of the travel journey is anybody's guess.
Wow. And so most people, for those reasons, are staying away and airlines are bleeding money. What does it look like economically for the airline industry?
Airlines are absolutely bleeding money. United Airlines yesterday reported earnings. In the earnings release, they said it was the worst quarter in the 94-year history of the airline. So worse than 9/11, the Great Recession, worse than everything. Their revenue was down something like 90%. They lost $2.6 billion in a three-month period. It is a disaster out there. Almost every U.S. airline is going to go through major layoffs or furloughs. United has been more aggressive. They sent furlough notices to 36,000 employees recently. Doesn't mean all of them will go, but a lot of them will go. The airline industry that people remember from a year or two ago, it's gone. It is not coming back for a long time. There's going to be a very long recovery period here, anywhere from about 2 to 5 years, people think.
And I guess there will be fewer airlines.
There will probably be fewer airlines. So far at this point, what we're seeing is every airline is going to be smaller, but there's no obvious airline candidate to go out of business. You know, from a historical basis, we actually have fewer airlines now than we did 20 or 30 years ago. People remember names like TWA and Eastern and Pan Am. There used to be a lot of weak airlines out there, and we had more airlines. Coming into this crisis, we had fewer airlines, and they were stronger. So it is possible that all the airlines that went into this will come out of this. It's just some of them are going to be a lot smaller.
Who is the most likely candidate to go out of business, do you think?
The weakest U.S. airline right now is considered American Airlines. They don't want to talk about bankruptcy. They say it's not possible. They say they're doing fine, but they have tens of billions of dollars of debt, and American needs passengers to come back very quickly. The others came into this with less debt and they're in comparatively better shape. And of course, the golden boy in all this is Southwest Airlines. Customers love Southwest. Investors love Southwest. They came into this with a strong balance sheet. In the past, Southwest has used a good crisis like 9/11 or the financial recession to actually grow at the expense of their competitors. And that may happen here as well.
So you said you flew a lot last year, a lot pre-COVID. Would you get on an airplane today?
I flew about 150,000 miles last year. It was my obsession. I flew every week or every other week. The best answer I can give you is no. I haven't flown through this crisis, and I have no plans to fly for a long time. And I am not unusual. United Airlines just had its earnings call. They say they're hopeful that they can get back to about 50% of demand. But they say in order to get beyond 50% of demand, they need a vaccine. They need a cure for this. They need people to forget about COVID. They have a huge number of their customers that they know just aren't coming back for any reason until it is safe to fly.
Brian, happy staycationing. Thank you for coming on today.
Thank you, Madeline.
Brian Summers covers airlines for Skift. And we are out of here, flying out of here. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.